times. Who doesn't dread going to the airport? The long security lines, the cumbersome boarding procedures, the delays, the extra fees, and the sardine-like seating arrangements all add up to make flying a hassle. But millions do it, especially during the summer months. Here to talk about the airline industry and air travel is Scott McCartney, the travel editor for the Wall Street Journal. He writes the weekly column called The Middle Seat. And Scott McCartney, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be with you, Marty.
And while flying can be stressful for the everyday traveler, it can be a frightening experience for those who are phobic. With us to talk about the fear of flying is psychologist Martin Seif. He specializes in the treatment of anxiety disorders, and he runs a program for fearful flyers out of the Westchester Airport in New York called Freedom to Fly. And Marty Seif, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Very pleased to be here.
And I am going to toggle back and forth between the two of you, but we want to cover, I guess, airline travel in all its various permutations. Scott, let me begin with you, and how would you assess the health of the airline industry as we speak?
It's a bit like my father-in-law suffered for many years from multiple sclerosis, and used to ask him how was he doing, and he said, "Well, I'm in good shape for the shape I'm in." And I think the airline industry is kind of in the same way. It's in fair shape, given all the afflictions that surround it. High oil prices are taking a very heavy toll. The industry had losses in the first quarter of $1 billion. They're the eight largest airlines in the U.S. And the first quarter is typically historically a time when they do lose money. They will no doubt make money in the second quarter because spring and summer is a busier travel season. But on the whole, this is an industry that really struggles to eke out even the smallest of profits in good times, and hasn't found a way to really be sustainably profit for the long run.
And Scott, I would say the last couple of times I have traveled, it has been a packed airplane. Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. I mean, it's really quite remarkable how airlines have been able to really pack more people onto airplanes. It used to be a while ago that 70% load factor, the percentage of seats filled, was really pretty good, and now we're seeing 85 and higher. And that means, just about any flight at any normal hour is going to be completely full. And the off-hour flights will have some empty seats. But it's a hassle for travelers and a problem for the industry, one I think they haven't figured out yet, which is if you run at such full capacity, how do you reaccommodate people when things go wrong? And we all know they do go wrong, and so you get a series of storms that cancel a bunch of flights. And then people end up waiting 3 and 4 days for an empty seat to get where they want to go.
And I want to pick up on that. But Marty Seif, let me get you in on this conversation.
Sure.
And I'm interested, and I do want to talk in some depth about the kind of work that you do, but also thinking about these packed airplanes. Now, I don't have claustrophobia, but one gets a sense of being really packed inside this tube with no place to go. Does that add to people who are phobic or fearful, add to their anxiety?
Certainly. Let me say something about fear of flying.
Okay. Because
the general term fear of flying really represents a confluence of phobias, all because of the fact that the vehicle of flying is a wonderful medium for a variety of different phobias. Mm-hmm. So when people say they're afraid of flying, they can mean that they have very different fears. But by far the most common underlying fear of flying is common claustrophobia. Mm-hmm. And so when people hear that their planes are packed, it increases their already phobic concerns. So they don't like that. Okay, most of the people who are severely afraid of flying, probably two-thirds of them would be classified as claustrophobic, and they don't like the idea of being packed in like sardines. Just the image frightens them and keeps them away.
And what do you suggest for someone that has that very specific fear, especially that kind of fear of flying? What do you suggest they do if they have to fly from Philadelphia to, Chicago?
Well, you're really talking about how does a person overcome a phobia, and how a person overcomes a fear of flying. And I don't know how much time you want me to spend going into it now, but certainly a person has to understand that they're sensitized to it, that um, the, the idea of being on a plane is filled with so many other sort of both miracles and fears to the person who flies, that sometimes it's hard for them to just to understand that what they're really afraid of is claustrophobia. Okay, so they have to kind of first understand the triggers that cause their fear and to, in some cases, practice coping with those feelings in other types of situations.
And let me just follow up, and then I'll get back to you, Scott McCartney. But when you talk about the miracle of flying, does it also, I don't have a fear of flying in a phobic kind of way, but there is a part of me that sort of doesn't understand how this plane gets off the ground. Marty Seif, does that sort of add to someone's
Absolutely.
Fear and anxiety?
There's a general rule that anxiety loves ignorance. And any time a person, people who are frightened tend to be what if catastrophic. They always tend to think of the, not always, but they often think of the worst case scenario. And when they have a little bit of information, the catastrophes are limited only by the creativity of their scary images. When they have a lot of information, when they know how a plane flies, when they have information about the industry, when they have information about how a plane flies and the safety record and the maintenance that goes on, then that tends to limit the fears that they have because it limits the room inside their mind to begin to catastrophize.
And Scott, have you looked at this issue yourself?
Yes, and Dr. Seif was quite helpful with a story we did not too long ago. It's a very widespread thing. The research I saw showed anywhere from 10 to 25% of people who travel have some form of fear. And I think it does make sense. I'm sitting in a hotel room right now at Los Angeles International Airport looking out on an airfield where there are machines that weigh hundreds of tons, and they're just sort of climbing by themselves into the air. It's a wonderful thing, but it's
now, can
a
I make
bit
a
illogical.
Comment about the figures that you just
yeah go ahead, Marty.
If this is relevant, it may be that anywhere from 10 to 20% of people who fly have a significant fear of flying. We really don't know that. These figures are bantered around, and no one has done a scientific survey of this. It could be that. The number that generally goes around is 20% of people. We don't know the people who don't fly because one figure, of course, which can be incorrect, is that less than half of the population of the United States ever flies.
Oh, really?
Okay. Now, that could be incorrect. This is a number that is the buzz that you hear, and in the field of mental health, prior to scientific studies, some of the figures that were bantered around were embarrassingly inaccurate when the actual data came out. But I wouldn't be surprised if, and I think there are a variety of reasons. There are social reasons, there are economic reasons, but certainly a component of that is fear. And specifically with flying, there's a huge component of anticipatory anxiety. If you're afraid of driving in your car, you can get in the car and see what it like feels driving down the driveway. You know, you can't do the same with a plane. You either get on the
Thank
plane
goodness.
And take the flight or you don't.
Well, and Scott, just to underscore the fact that flying is safe, certainly safer than driving in a car, yes?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. No, statistically, and flying, even since the 1980s, has gotten significantly safer than it was then, and world safer than before the dawn of the jet age.
Martin, Steve, let me go back to you because you mentioned the kind of anticipatory anxiety, and I would say that's how I deal with flying, which is that before I get on the plane, I go through all these disaster scenarios, and I imagine my life ending. Frankly, it doesn't prevent me from flying, but in fact, once I get on the plane, I figure, oh, what the heck. You know, whatever happens, happens, and I'm fine. Is that pretty common, would you say?
I think that might be common with a number of people who have what I would consider low-level fears of flying, where they just kind of represent, sort of acknowledge the fact that they're going to be that high up in that vulnerable position. Mm-hmm. Most people who drive don't go through that sort of anticipatory anxiety in which they go through all the catastrophic consequences, even though in your mind you know that if you're going to drive from Philadelphia to New York, you have a far greater chance of dying in a crash than if you fly. So it's not related to the actual danger of the flight. It's related to the imagery that you feel. But I want to get back to your question, because the fact is that the people who are afraid of flying are sensitized to that imagery, and that's a big thing. And if people are listening to this now, they can identify that. They have this thought, and that thought creates a real physiological whoosh in their body, and it changes their state of consciousness. They achieve a kind of altered state of consciousness in which the thoughts that they're thinking, these catastrophic what-if thoughts, what if the plane goes down, what if the wings fall off, you know, what if the plane, you know, what if Delta goes on strike, all these different things in the middle of the flight, those thoughts begin to feel like real. And the anxiety makes the thoughts feel like they're really happening. And so they're not sure whether they're just thinking it or living it in some way. So the terror starts to feel very real. And it's hard for them to hold on to the fact that they're just feeling anxious. They really begin to feel that they're in a life-threatening situation, even though a part of their brain is saying, this is much safer than any other way of getting from point A to point B.
I want to pick up on that. But first to you, Scott, we're going to try to call you back and get you on a better phone line. We're getting a lot of disruption here, and I want to make sure
Are you talking to me?
No, I'm actually talking to Scott.
Okay.
So you hang up. We'll call you back. And, Marty, see if you can stay with us as we continue our conversation.
Sure.
We have about a minute and a half before our first break here. But it sounds like when we talk about fear of flying in the sort of broad sense is that it's anxiety about anxiety.
Exactly. I mean, that basically is the key to all of sort of anxiety disorders. And people who, being anxious about being anxious is what sets up the stage for a person to feel panic. If a person is anxious and is absolutely clear that they can handle that anxiety, that it won't spiral into greater anxiety, then they can actually calm down with it. And that's what we would call normal anxiety.
Right.
Everyone feels anxiety. The difference between a person who really has a terror, a phobia of flying, let's say with flying, is that they become afraid of the fear. And there are triggers of that, so they're afraid. And the triggers are various triggers. Some people who are afraid of flying are claustrophobic. They know who they are. They wish they could open the windows. Other people who are afraid of flying don't like heights. They wish the plane would fly at kind of treetop heights, not too high. Other people don't like turbulence. They don't like the image of the plane shaking. Sometimes they don't like the sensations that it feels. There are probably 6 or 7 or 8 specific triggers that sort of come together under the single heading of fear of flying. But underneath it all is the fear that the fear will become intolerable. And so it sounds like gobbledygook, but it's actually true. It's not so much the fear, it's the fear of the fear. It's not so much the feeling, it's the way they feel about the feeling. And you have it exactly right, Marty.
Well, thank you for that. Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with psychologist Martin Seif, and he specializes in the treatment of anxiety disorders, including fear of flying. And we have reconnected with Scott McCartney. He covers the airline industry for the Wall Street Journal, writes a weekly column on airlines and travel called The Middle Seat, opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Einstein Healthcare Network supports WHYY. For people who suffer from chronic pain and aren't able to participate in daily activities, the Einstein Pain Institute offers specialized care in pain management. Through clinical trials, experience, and commitment to quality, Einstein addresses complex issues both to manage and relieve pain. Einstein uses a team approach to create a customized plan to meet individual needs. Einstein Healthcare Network. For more information or for an appointment, 1-800-EINSTEIN.
This week in This American Life, when one of our producers, Sarah Koenig, started talking to people about natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania, things got intense.
So how many times do we have to plug it? Do we have to plug it in?
You're yelling at me.
I'm yelling at you.
How industry, universities, and politicians all came to agree that natural gas is a game changer for the economy, for our energy problems.
My levels are off the charts here.
I'm sorry.
This week.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
He was a member of NASA's 18th shuttle mission aboard the shuttle Discovery. And when Prince Sultan Salman Abdulaziz Al Saud took his ride into the cosmos, he became the first Muslim to fly into outer space. As part of our Flying High series, we speak with Prince Sultan next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are talking about flying and the fear of flying with our guests, Scott McCartney and Martin Seif. And we have calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Scott, hopefully we've got you on a better phone here. Let me ask you about what appears to be a new way of boarding people on airplanes. And I'm not sure if they fixed the problem or not, but what are airlines trying to do to make this a more sort of orderly, less chaotic, and more streamlined process?
Well, I think actually the way the trend is going, airlines are trying to make this a way that they can charge people for early access to boarding. Traditionally, airlines have boarded planes from the rear to the front. That seemed to make the most sense. Delta and some others go from window seats outward to aisle seats and try and put people in that way. But American has just switched to a process where basically your boarding group, unless you're an elite level flyer or first class passenger, your boarding group is determined by when you pronounce your boarding pass. It's first come, first serve. And then they're offering the ability to buy into their first general group after the elite for paying $10 or $15 for the right to get to jump the line a bit. Several airlines started with the discount carriers. Southwest certainly does it quite a bit. With Southwest, it does matter because it's open seating and you select your seat. But fees are coming to the boarding process, and just as they have about every other aspect of travel,
including baggage and food and beverages and all of that. Is that where airlines are making their money?
It is. The industry would not, most likely would not have been profitable last year, absent baggage fees and reservation change fees and all the other, kind of nickel and diming that goes on in the business. It's a model that, airlines say, it's all a cart. You pay for what you actually use. If you don't check a bag, you don't pay. If you do check a bag and use the service, you do pay. Passengers have long felt that when you travel, you got to take something with you. You don't go naked, and so baggage ought to be part of the cost. Just as when you check into a hotel room, you don't get charged an extra fee for the bed or the television. It's turned into a huge amount of money for airlines, and with high fuel prices, it really has saved the industry from more bankruptcy.
And why do you think there was a recent customer satisfaction index, Scott? Why do you think customers, the airline customers, are so frustrated with the industry?
Well, I think there's been a huge amount of change in the industry. The travel experience is kind of one giant hassle. The industry is not particularly reliable. Bad things happen to people. You can't get help when things go wrong. There are all of those frustrations. But, I really think the bottom line of this is there's an adversarial relationship here between airlines and their customers, and it's unhealthy. The customer feels, and the fees are a huge part of this. Customer feels like the airline's trying to, take advantage of them at every turn, and it's really worn thin. There's no goodwill.
Right, but it's interesting that the customer satisfaction is so important to most industries. I mean, that's how you get repeat customers.
Yeah, the airline industry is really a bit different. It's not where you want to go may determine what airlines you could possibly fly. Some routes there may not be much choice. Some routes the choice may be a nonstop flight, or gee, if I want to fly a different airline, I've got to make a connection, and that's an added hassle, maybe an added expense. So it's not like the television business where you can go to a store and look at it just about any brand you want. Sometimes in this business you don't have a lot of choice. The other thing that really drives people crazy are airline fares and the game that airlines play of changing prices continually, sometimes several different times a day.
and the illogical things that go into airline pricing, where one trip that may be a whole lot longer is actually cheaper than a shorter trip. Those kinds of things drive people crazy. And it's the same customers that, you know, one day going from Philadelphia to Chicago and the next day going from Philadelphia to Los Angeles. And they, you know, why in the world is it cheaper to go to L.A. than Chicago? It can really frustrate consumers.
Indeed. Martin Seif, I do want to talk about your program, but let me get a caller in. And we have John from Mount Airy joining us on Radio Times. And, John, go ahead. You're on the air. There we go. Go ahead.
A couple of things. One, I used to have a real fear of flying. I was just very nervous about it. And on a recent flight, a friend told me something which really helped. He said, John, whenever an airline goes down anywhere in the world, it's on the front page or in the A section. You don't have to worry until it goes to the B section of the newspaper. The auto accidents are.
I hear you.
And that really helped me calm down because I could grasp the fact that it happens so infrequently that it's always big news when it does. The other thing is about the flights and all that. How do you think internet has changed how airlines do pricing and how they react to customers? When I fly, I always go through Kayak or Priceline or something like that, and I'm looking for the best deal to get to where I'm going when I need to go. And I'm not conscious necessarily of baggage fees and all that type of stuff. I'm just aware of what's the cheapest price to get me where I have to go. And I accept the fact that I have to wait to board. You know, that's one reason they make books.
Well, I hear you. And let me toss that to you, Scott, and then Martin, see if I do want to expand on something that John said and also your program as well. But the role of the Internet, Scott, and for pricing, and John says he doesn't even think about these fees. Should he start thinking about them?
Well, I think he should. But John's hit on exactly why baggage fees are working, because most consumers do click, 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 look at the screen, take the cheapest price, and off they go. And that's the fundamental problem that airlines had had. The airline industry was delighted when the Internet came along because they said, we can connect directly with our customers. We can basically sell tickets without going through the middleman of a travel agent, which was sort of the old model and expensive for airlines. And what's happened is the Internet, as in every other business, has given people a lot more pricing information. The ability to compare prices instantly and easily has made the industry somewhat more price competitive, but more importantly, made the consumer extremely price sensitive.
Mm.
And so it's the consumer chasing the absolute lowest fare that's forced airlines into this mindset that we have to have the lowest fare, regardless of our costs are higher, our product's better, or whatever. We still have to match that lowest fare. And so there hasn't been... And I always thought there was room, certainly room. You see it in the retail business. There are Walmarts and there are Nordstroms and there are Tiffany's and there's a broad spectrum of retailers. And we don't have that in the airline industry, where some airline would say, you know, we're going to offer better service and we're not going to worry about matching the absolute lowest price.
John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Marty Seif, let me have you explain to our listeners about this program that you run, and this is out of Westchester Airport. It's called Freedom to Fly, where you help some of these anxious, nervous flyers deal with some of their anxieties.
Okay, thank you. Well, first of all, they're anxious, nervous flyers, but there are lots of people who take the program who haven't flown for 1, 2, 3, 5, 10, or 15 years, who have never flown.
Mm.
So these are the extreme end of nervous flyers. And the program that I run, which was started about 13 years ago, is a 6-session group experience in which people meet at the airport. They go through, this is the Westchester Airport,
mm-hmm,
in Westchester, New York. And the program is run through the Anxiety and Phobia Treatment Center at White Plains Hospital. the people meet and they go through security. They we meet on the other side of security, and there are a bunch of lectures. I try to provide a model for them to explain the very kind of confusing fact for them that, in fact, they know, for example, that it is much more dangerous to drive from New York to Boston, because we meet in the New York area, or D.C., and yet then fly, and yet they would far more easily drive to those locations than fly. So why are they more afraid of things that are objectively less dangerous? That's the question we start with.
Right.
And it's a confusing issue. And I try to provide a model, and there's a lot of education. We have a retired American airline pilot, Dick Bracken, who comes and talks to us. Two of the sessions, we board stationary planes. AirTrain is very kind to provide us with a plane that has just come in from usually either Chicago or Florida or something, and they allow us to get on the plane, and people sit on the plane for a while. And this is a model for how to overcome your fear. The active ingredient in overcoming any anxiety is exposure. And people who are afraid of flying have a difficulty in maintaining manageable or gradual steps of exposure. And this program tries to do that. After the fifth session, we go on a conditioning flight, either to Boston or D.C., spend a few hours in that area, turn around and come back. And then we have a kind of a final session in which people talk about the experience that they've had. It's been going on for about 13 years, as I said. And after 9/11, we thought that we were just not going to be able to run it anymore. But we have wonderful cooperation from the TSA, the airport, and the particular airline, which provides us with the stationary plane.
Let me get, looks like Tammy from Estelle Manor to join us on Radio Times, and sounds like she has something for you, Martin Seif. And Tammy, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, Martin.
Hi,
thank you for addressing this subject.
You're welcome.
I guess my question is for the doctor. Normally, I'm not an anxious person, but even as you're describing and when Marty was describing how she prepares to get on the plane, I had symptoms manifesting themselves, mm-hmm. like my heartbeat raced and I was getting panicked. Even began to cry a little bit. And so I guess my question is it a cop-out to get medication for that type of those type of symptoms? Because I've really had some events in the air that they upset the cabin, actually. You know, panic attacks. I've had to have a stewardess sit with me. And so I just was curious about if that's something that an avenue I could go down.
Okay, let me
go ahead, Marty.
Speak more generally, because if people are listening, you said you had some events during flying, and what most people when they hear, or most of my patients when they hear events, they think that there was something that was either dangerous in the flight. And now my guess is what you're saying, that you became very anxious during a flight, and you became so anxious during the flight that you couldn't really control yourself. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that
yes,
is. That
yes.
Is.
Okay. Breathing.
Okay.
Hiatal breathing, just kind of making noise.
Yeah, and really what happens is that when people experience symptoms of panic and they don't have manageable tools to cope with them, it feels overwhelming and the panic can go on for quite a while. Usually one of the things that needs to be done in any treatment of an anxiety disorder, and certainly for fear of flying, is to understand the fact that there's the possibility of experience panic, to understand what's happening to that, and to learn techniques for managing those feelings so that the panics is moderate and minimal as possible. Usually when a person is well educated about a panic, they actually don't panic in the situation. But you're also talking about something else, which is anticipatory anxiety, which is when we talk about it, you have an intense reaction to it. And the general way of I look at it is that you're sensitized to that, and you're going to get that physiological reaction. I believe that overcoming a fear of flying, I went into this field to try to cure my own phobia, and I did a pretty good job because I didn't fly until I was about 29 years old. I was too afraid of flying. So I understand from both sides of the couch, so to speak, what it is to be afraid of flying. And I think it's a I hope I'm not just patting myself on the back, but I think it's a courageous action to get into a situation in which you know, which you expect to feel such fear. And I think it's an understandable definition of courage. If, in fact, medication helps you to approach eventually flying medication-free, I think by all means, take medication. It's not a cop-out. Just understand that everything has a plus and negative side. Medication might make the anxiety more manageable. It will not take it away completely, but it might make the anxiety more manageable. But in the long term, your goal is to become a comfortable flyer. And all the studies also indicate that the active ingredient in overcoming anxiety is exposure. When you are exposed with medication, you have somewhat less of a therapeutic effect because of the effects of medication. So the medications help to approach the place, the situation, but in the long term, the medications actually reduce the effectiveness of exposure. And you're going to try to titrate between the two and make a decision between the two. But it is certainly not a cop-out to do that. It's a courageous action to do something that frightens you.
Tammy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Scott, let me go back to you. And I can see from our callers a lot of people with questions about flying fears. Would you say the personnel, the flight attendants and people on airplanes with travelers, that they are trained in this and know how to handle some of the anxieties that people might be having?
I think most flight attendants would tell you they don't get much training in this, but they do have a lot of experience. And I think there are lots and lots of concerned professionals in the cockpit who can help and do, you know, whether it's spotting the nervous flyer and offering some comforting words or paying particular attention to them. At the same time, you hear from travelers who, you know, flight attendants are unhappy in their work or overworked or don't have time, and some can see fearful flyers as more of a problem to avoid or to have to watch out for, or things like that, as opposed to trying to help the person. You know, flight attendants spend a lot of time scanning the passengers to see who might be a problem for them, and nervous flyers can fall into that category.
Yeah, can I give you my perspective on
that?
Yeah,
very briefly, because we're almost up on a break here.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I want to tell you that we fly usually the Delta shuttle, and we announce beforehand to the pilots that we're coming on, and the pilots do a fabulous job of coming out and talking to our group or letting us board early. And we've had flight attendants who, whatever their training is, they clearly know what to do, who have been absolutely fantastic during some of our bumpier flights, and talking and reassuring some of our very nervous flyers. And whatever their training is, I don't know, but that we've had some really wonderful flight attendants.
You know what? We're going to take a very short break. And Scott, I'm just afraid we're going to lose you on your cell phone. It's sounding a little skanky. but in any case, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Okay, good to be with you, Martin.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. Scott McCartney,
good to be with you, Scott.
And he covers the airline industry for the Wall Street Journal. Martin Seif staying with us for the rest of the hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Have you adopted a child internationally? If you have an adopted child between the ages of 9 and 36 months, you may be eligible to participate in a program funded by the National Institutes of Health. By participating, you will contribute to what is known about the development of adopted children and take part in an interactive parenting program. Further details are available by phone at 302-831-6611 or at infantcaregiverproject.com. The University of Delaware supports WHYY.
Dr. Paul Farmer has spent 30 years treating the poor in Haiti, Rwanda, Russia, and elsewhere. He was appointed the UN Deputy Special Envoy to Haiti.
One thing we have to acknowledge is that if you look at Haiti, many billions of dollars have gone into development aid there that have not been effective.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Farmer. His new book is Haiti After the Earthquake. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll try to separate fact from fiction in the debt ceiling debate. Also, pet stores refuse to sell puppies to people who are drunk. Who knew there was such a problem? Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Motz-Cohen. And again, we just said goodbye to Scott McCartney, who covers the airline industry for the Wall Street Journal. But we asked Martin Seif, to stay with us for the rest of the hour. He's a psychologist in private practice in the New York City and Greenwich, Connecticut area, specializes in the treatment of anxiety disorders. He's associate director of the Anxiety and Phobia Treatment Center at White Plains Hospital on the faculty of the New York Presbyterian Hospital, and he runs a program for fearful flyers out of the Westchester Airport in New York called Freedom to Fly. And just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any fears of flying, do give us a call. Martin Seif, I'm curious about if you're sitting next to someone, or perhaps you have a family member or a friend that you're flying with, and you see that they are getting anxious. Are there things, as just a friend or family member, that you should or shouldn't say?
In general, yeah. It would be nice if you could find out beforehand what a person likes when they're feeling anxious, because people have a variety of different responses to that. But in general, to say to a person, it's all right to be anxious, to recognize the fact that they're going through some experience, and to ask them, what would you like me to do to try to be helpful to you? Okay, even when they're feeling anxious, they can kind of tell you. At times, they want to be spoken to.
Mm-hmm.
At times, they might want to be left alone. At times, I might say, you know, sing me a song or talk to me or touch me or hold my hand. Other times, they say, leave me alone because I'm focusing on trying to make sure this plane stays up in the air or whatever that I'm doing. So I think it would be important to take the lead from the person who has that anxiety.
But I hear you saying, don't say to that person, oh, there's nothing to be afraid of.
People hate that. I didn't say that, but I should have said that.
That's okay.
Don't say there's nothing to be afraid of. Don't say, oh, look at how beautiful it is.
Love these clouds outside.
You know, just think of how great, what a miracle it is to be 35,000 feet above the ground. All the things that you particularly might feel, or for people who say, well, you know, I when I get on a plane, I always figure to myself, if it's my time, it's my time, you know, and I sort of feel calm with that. That's generally not to be that's not to comfort other people who are particularly anxious. What they're struggling with at that time is that there's a lot of kind of what-if catastrophic imagery going through their mind, and they're struggling with the thought that they might not be able to hold it together.
Right, or hold the plane up, right? I mean, with the sort of magical thinking that can come with that.
You have it exactly right. Okay, that hold the plane up. But in a sense, ultimately, what we would like them to know is that what they're afraid of is some internal sensation inside of them, and that when they're anxious, that's when they become exactly magical thinking, where they know that they really don't hold the plane up, but it's almost like if they don't focus on it, maybe something bad would happen. And it's almost, when you're very anxious, there's almost like a really strong superstition at that time, and you have to focus on it. So take the lead from the person next to you. Try to talk to them even before you get on the plane about what you think it's going to be, what they might like help with.
Well, let me get back to our callers. The phones have filled up. We have Todd from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. And Todd, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead, Todd.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've never been afraid to fly, but the anxiety that I experience is everything that you have to go through to get on the plane. And some years ago, I was flying out of Philadelphia. I had my musical instrument with me, which is expensive and valuable, and I couldn't get the security guard to understand that you had to open the case right side up, and my expensive instrument nearly tumbled out upside down, which would have caused a lot of damage. And I just find everything you have to go through to get on an airplane more causing more anxiety for me than anything else. I just you know, find that to be more of the problem lately.
Well, Todd,
thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome. Let me see what Marty Seif says. Go ahead.
Well, I think the people who are really kind of dyed-in-the-wool, really intense flying phobics, consider that to be sort of optional. I don't think they like the idea of going through security. It frightens them even more. They feel kind of trapped on one side as opposed to the other. But for them, I think it's the actual flying experience that really scares them. Okay, so I doubt that there have been a greater number of fearful flyers ever since these additional security measures have been placed. I think that the number of people who are afraid of flying, either avoid flying or significantly alter their flying schedule because of their fears, probably has remained pretty constant.
Well, the security measures are supposed to make us feel more secure, are they not? Even if it's a hassle to go through all those lines.
Well, that's a good point. But in fact, if you're primarily claustrophobic, there are a few people, a small percentage of people who are fearful. Their primary fear of flying is the fear of being of some sort of hijacking.
Oh.
And they get some degree of comfort from the security measures, but it's not a great deal.
Let me see what Larry from Reading has to say. And Larry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I had a fear of flying for several years, and it was caused, I think, by two things. The lack of control, that I was at somebody else's mercy. When I was driving, I had the illusion, at least, of being in control. I could stop when I wanted to stop. If I wanted something to eat, I'd get something to eat. And the second reason was the fear of the unknown. The flight attendants, in fact, no one aboard, tells you what this experience will be like. They don't tell you that there are air pockets, that there are bumps, what causes these bumps. And I think it'd be a good idea, at least if the flight attendant says, you know, how many people, is this their first flight experience? This is what you can expect. This is what the engines will sound like. This is why there are bumps up here. Nothing to worry about.
Well, that's interesting.
They take their time doing other things, showing you where the emergency exits are, all the panicky things, how to make a water landing, whatever the hell that is. But not enough time explaining, you know, what you're about to experience.
Well, that's pretty interesting, Larry. Let me see what Marty Seif has to say.
I have some comments about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I want to also mention that the industry really doesn't exactly know how to deal with that. That's my guess from that, although I wish Scott were here to confirm that with me. Mm-hmm. But let me, first of all, lack of control is something which is paramount among virtually anyone who has a significant fear. And there are people, for example, who have tremendous fears of flying, say in the group, who say, you know, I'd have no problem flying to Boston if I could fly the plane. And, of course, the immediate response is you might not have problems, but everybody else in the group would have tremendous problems with it because these are very skilled pilots and you don't know what you're doing. But the illusion, the caller is correct, the illusion of control that you have when you're driving is something that people find comfortable versus the illusion of non-control. And, of course, the answer to that riddle is that the idea is not to control the plane. The idea is to control your internal processes that create the anxiety. But getting back to the second question, which is the fear of the unknown and what's the role of the industry, and you were suggesting the flight attendant, in educating their consumers. And I think the industry really doesn't know how to deal with that. For example, about 25 years ago, American Airlines started a very ambitious program to work with people who are afraid of flying. And they hired a really fabulous psychologist named Reed Wilson to head that program. And they put a lot of energy into it for about 2 years. And then they abruptly abandoned it. Now, I have never been in any of the boardrooms of their corporate decisions or whatever, but the general thought among my profession is that the industry is caught between a rock and a hard place. On one hand, they know that they lose business because of people who are afraid of flying, and probably people's fears of flying makes the flying experience less pleasant for a whole variety of people. But on the other hand, to acknowledge that fear perhaps it makes it too explicit, and maybe that would cut into their business also. They don't want to make it too explicit that people are afraid of flying and what are the dangers that they're afraid of. So they're between a rock and a hard place. And certainly for the last 10 or 15 years, the industry has put very little, if no, effort into educating people about flying and the various aspects of flying. And that's an important aspect of overcoming anxiety. Education is a very powerful component in helping person overcome their phobias or their anxiety.
Larry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And just picking up on that very briefly, the last couple times, though, I've flown, the pilot has come on to say, you know, there's a bumpy patch ahead and we're gonna detour and go blah, blah, you know, in some kind of direction. And I have to frankly say I appreciate that. But it sounds like perhaps they could do more of that just to sort of help people understand what this flight or this experience might be about.
Well, one of the things that we do in our program is that we teach a person what turbulence is, because almost universally people afraid of flying are also afraid of turbulence, and they believe that it creates an additional danger. What our pilots tell us in the program that I run, again, I wish Scott were here to be the authoritative person in that, is that, in fact, there is airlines have very little to compete with. They all charge this pretty much the same. Their routes are determined, and their online performance is really determined by the conditions at the airport. So the only thing they can provide is comfort. Okay, the only thing they compete with is comfort. And although turbulence is not a dangerous situation, universally, passengers do not like the experience of turbulence. So pilots will often communicate with the ground or communicate with airlines that are in front of them and look for calmer air and then communicate to the passengers that they're going to go into a calmer air region. And passengers like that, but it's all under the comfort zone. It has nothing to do with safety.
Let me see what Barbara from Ardmore has to say. Larry, thanks for the call. And Barbara, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, well, I was calling about turbulence, exactly.
There you go. Go ahead.
And I fly for conferences, so I have to do it. But I was coming in from San Francisco to Philly over the Rockies, landing in Denver, and they warned us. They said the stewards would stay strapped in. It was really frightening. So when I got to Denver, I thought, I can't take off again. I can't get in another plane. So I saw this pilot sitting by himself, you know, looking at his laptop, and I went up and I said, talk to me about the wind. He said, lady, what do you want to know, which way it's blowing? And I said, no, I'm asking you to tell me that turbulence is okay. But I will say this, when your speaker right now was saying that comfort, BA plays really comforting music when it does its, you know, announcements about potential tragedy.
Well, wait, but Barbara, what did the pilot, though, say to you?
What he joked with me, lady, what do you want to know? Which way it's blowing? And I said, no, I want you to tell me that the plane is not going to break in half.
Right. And what did he say?
When the wind is that.
And what did he say?
Well, I think he thought I was, shall I say, crazy.
Well, part of the problem is that some of the personnel don't understand the severity of the fear and the creativity of the fantasies that we have. And a lot of people are afraid that the wings are going to fall off or break off, especially when you look out and you see the wings moving. And the fact is that there is, and this is something that we try to really impress upon all the people in our flying programs, all the people I see are afraid of flying, that turbulence in some way... Okay, turbulence in some way has a zero increase in the danger of a flight. Okay?
That's good to
it
know.
Does not change it at all. However, there is one there's one exception to that. People have to realize that thunderstorms can be dangerous to planes. And my understanding now, I'm quoting from our pilot who speak to us, that in the United States, airplanes are not allowed to fly within 20 miles of a thunderstorm. So that, in fact, and as a matter of fact, this is a terrible term, but when they deadhead a plane, when they move an empty plane from one airport to another, they have a small crew that flies the plane from one airport to another. They don't bother going around turbulence.
They go right through.
because it doesn't make any difference from a danger point of view, and these people don't care about being bumped around.
That's very interesting. Let me see if I can squeeze one more caller in, and this is Kathy calling us from Philadelphia. Kathy, you have about 30 seconds. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay, great. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I became afraid of flying after I had my children and I became a mother, and it was such a huge problem. My anxiety was so bad that I actually I got EMDR. Do you know what that is? It's the treatment.
Sure.
Almost like hypnosis. And it helped me figure out that I was afraid of being out of control, but it didn't really help me resolve the fear. So what I do now is have a glass of wine, and that makes me a little calmer.
Let me just tell you
Thanks, Kathy.
If we're talking about the development of fears, they tend to occur during periods of transitions in a person's life. A birth, a death, a marriage, a divorce, it could be a good change, getting a job promotion, a bad change, losing a job. And there are also certain critical times. The average age of onset of this would be age 23. If you're 15, you're young. If you're 37, you're kind of old. 95% of all panics occur before the age of 40. So you're right in there with that. And EMDR is a form of therapy that certainly people are very interested in. I have some friends who are experts in it. I wouldn't consider myself an expert in it. It wouldn't be a frontline form of treatment today for the sort of anxiety that you have. And there are a whole variety of more mainline treatments now that have some evidence to suggest that they're fairly effective.
And what about one glass of wine?
You know, alcohol is a great minor tranquilizer. Here's the thing with alcohol.
Very quickly.
A glass of wine is fine. The problem is when you think if one is good, then two or three is going to be twice or three times better. You basically max out after your first glass of wine. After that, it starts to work in the other direction.
Well, psychologist Marty Seif, thank you for joining us today on Radio
You're
Times.
Welcome.
And he runs a program called Freedom to Fly, and that's out of Westchester Airport in New York. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for those phone calls as well. I'm Marty Moskowain.